The house was silent, but it was not the peaceful silence of sleep. It was the heavy, suffocating quiet of a room where a storm had just passed, and the air still held the electric charge of lightning. Ren stood in the center of the hallway, her keys still clenched in her fist, the metal biting into her palm. The iron of the front door clicked shut behind her, a final, hollow sound that seemed to echo in the hollows of her ribs. She had been gone less than 12 hours. She had walked 3 miles to the station, taken the night train to Birmingham, spent a cold, stiff night in a third-class compartment that smelled of damp wool and unwashed bodies, and returned before dawn. And yet, the house felt different. It felt like it was holding its breath. She did not turn on the gas lamps. The gray light of early morning was sufficient, filtering through the high windows of the hall, illuminating the dust motes that danced in the stagnant air. She moved through the house like a ghost, her footsteps muffled by the thick carpet, her hand trailing along the banister. The brass was dull. She could see it now, in the weak light, the smudges, the oxidation, the neglect. She had polished it yesterday, or was it the day before? Time had become fluid, slipping through her fingers like the ash she had held in Birmingham. In the office, the ledger lay open on the desk. She had left it there, face up, on the page for Thomas Mercer. It looked like an accusation. The red leather cover seemed to pulse in the dim light, a wound that would not close. Ren stood before it for a long time, her hand hovering over the page, afraid to touch it, afraid not to. She pulled the chair out and sat down. The wood scraped against the floor, a harsh, grating sound that made her jump. She looked at the entry, March 3rd, male, 73, natural causes, service, standard cremation, fee, £12. £12 was what Mrs. Mercer had paid for her husband's ashes, for the urn that sat on her mantelpiece, heavy with the weight of grief and empty of the man she had loved. Ren closed her eyes. She tried to remember the look on Mrs. Mercer's face when she had handed over the check. It had been a face of quiet dignity, of a woman who had accepted her loss with grace. She had thanked Ren. She had said that Elias would have wanted it done properly. Elias. Her father's name tasted like ash in her mouth. She opened her eyes and looked at the ledger again. The ink was black, permanent, undeniable. These were not estimates. These were records. These were facts. And the facts were lying. She thought of the timber mill. She thought of the sacks of ash that Silas had been buying for 20 years. Fine powder, gray and tasteless, blown from the boilers of the mill that had shut down 2 years ago. Her father had been buying it by the sack, loading it into the urns, sealing them with wax, and handing them to the widows with a nod and a promise of eternal rest. 47 bodies. The number echoed in her head. 47 names, 47 families, 47 lies. Arthur Gable rose in her mind. Then Maeve Collins. The urn in Maeve's house, too light to be real, weighed heavily on her thoughts. She recalled Maeve's blue eyes, wide and frightened, asking if her husband's hands were truly inside. Have you checked, Maeve had whispered, ever? Ren had not answered. She could not answer, because the answer was no. She had never checked. She had never questioned. She had trusted her father. She had trusted the system. She had trusted the silence. And now the silence was screaming. She stood up abruptly, the chair falling backward with a crash. She paced the length of the office, her hands clasped behind her back, her mind racing. What was she supposed to do? What was anyone supposed to do? If she exposed the truth, the funeral home would be ruined. The reputation of the Holloway name would be destroyed. Silas would lose everything. The town of Oakhaven, which relied on the funeral home for its employment, its economy, its sense of order, would be thrown into chaos. The mill was already gone. The town was struggling to survive. To add scandal to poverty would be to break what little remained. But if she did nothing, she was complicit. She was continuing the lie. She was adding her name to the list of those who had profited from the dead. She walked to the window and looked out at the street. The town was waking up. She could see the baker lighting his ovens, the smell of yeast drifting through the open window. She could see the postman making his rounds, the mailbag slung over his shoulder. Life went on, indifferent to the rot in the basement. She thought of her mother. Her mother had died 10 years ago, before the fraud had reached its peak, before Elias had become desperate. Had her mother known? Had she suspected? Or had she lived in the blissful ignorance that Ren had tried to maintain? Her mother had been a good woman. She had believed in God, in justice, in the sanctity of the body. She would have been horrified. Ren pressed her forehead against the cold glass. She felt tears pricking her eyes, hot and shameful. She was angry. She was angry at her father. She was angry at Silas. She was angry at herself. Why had she not looked closer? Why had she been so blind? Because it was easier. Because the truth was too heavy to carry. Because she had wanted to believe that her father was a good man, that he had done good work, that he had served his community with honor. But he hadn't. He had sold his dead. He had sold his neighbors. He had sold his soul. And now it was hers. The weight of it settled on her shoulders, heavy and cold. She was the keeper of the ledger. She was the heir to the sin. She was the one who had to decide what to do with it. She turned away from the window and walked back to the desk. She picked up the ledger. It was heavier than she remembered. Heavier than paper and ink should be. It felt like lead. It felt like guilt. She opened it to the first page. The handwriting was her father's, precise and looped, the same handwriting she had seen on the box labels in the archive room. January 1, 1874. Establishment of Halloway and Son, funeral directors and cremators. It started innocently enough. Standard burials, coffins, flowers, fees that matched the market rate. But as she turned the pages, the entries changed. The fees remained the same, but the descriptions grew vague. Standard cremation. Ashes returned to family. No further action required. And then, the payments for the ash. June 12, 1880. Purchase of mill residue. Halloway and Son account. £5. £5 for a sack of ash. £5 for a lie. She flipped through the pages, faster now, her heart pounding in her chest. The numbers climbed. The years passed. The town grew. The deaths increased. And the ash flowed in, sack by sack, urn by urn, filling the void where the dead should have been. 47. She stopped at the last entry. October 14, 1883, Arthur Gable, £18. 6 months ago. 6 months ago, she had stood in the parlor and watched Mrs. Gable weep over an empty urn. 6 months ago, she had held the hand of a widow and promised her that her husband was at rest. She closed the book, she set it down, she put her head in her hands and wept. She wept for her father, she wept for the dead, she wept for the widows, she wept for herself. The tears came slowly at first, then in a rush, hot and bitter. She cried until her throat was raw, until her eyes were swollen and her nose was running. She cried until there was nothing left. And then silence. The house was quiet again. The dust motes continued their dance. The gas lamps hissed softly in their brackets. And Ren Halloway sat alone in the office, staring at the ledger, wondering if she had the strength to bear the weight of the truth. Ren Halloway sat alone in the office, staring at the ledger, wondering if she had the strength to bear the weight of the truth. She did not move, she did not eat, she did not drink. She simply sat and she thought. She thought about the town council, she thought about the magistrate, she thought about the police. If she went to the authorities, what would happen? Would they believe her? Would they care? Or would they look at the damage, at the ruined reputation, at the economic collapse, and decide that the truth was not worth the cost? She thought about Silas. He would beg her to stop. He would say that it was too late, that the dead should be left in peace, that the living needed stability. He would use her mother's memory against her. He would use the town's suffering against her. He would make her feel guilty for seeking justice. And she would want to listen. She would want to believe him, because it was easier, because the truth was too heavy. But she couldn't. She couldn't go back. She couldn't unsee what she had seen. She couldn't unlearn what she had learned. She stood up. Her legs were stiff, her back ached, but she stood. She walked to the door and opened it. The hallway was bright now, the morning sun pouring in through the windows, casting long rectangles of light on the floor. She looked down the hall, towards the front door, towards the street, towards the world. She didn't know what she was going to do. She didn't know if she was brave enough. But she knew one thing. She couldn't stay here. She couldn't pretend anymore. She took a deep breath. The air smelled of polish and old paper, of formaldehyde and lilies. It smelled of her father's house. It smelled of her inheritance. She stepped out into the hallway. She closed the door behind her, and she began to walk. She didn't know where she was going, but she knew she had to move. She had to think. She had to find a way to balance the scales, to weigh the destruction of the town's economy against the violation of the dead, to find the moral crossroads that lay ahead. And she would find it, not today, not tomorrow, but soon. Because she was Wren Holloway, and she was done being silent. The house breathed around her. The clocks ticked. The brass shone. And Wren Holloway walked out of the office, leaving the ledger behind, carrying the weight of the truth in her heart. She went to the kitchen. She boiled the kettle. She made a cup of tea. She sat at the table and drank it slowly, watching the steam rise and dissipate. Then she went upstairs. She went to her room. She lay down on the bed. She closed her eyes. She did not sleep. She lay there awake, listening to the house, listening to the town, listening to the silence. And she waited.